You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, SixthSense. SixthSense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With SixthSense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose SixthSense, visit SixthSense.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. Our guests today are Paul Cruikshank and Tim Lister. Paul is a CNN terrorism analyst and investigative reporter specializing in Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and jihadist terrorist groups. He's an alumni fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University's School of Law, and previously worked as an investigative journalist in London, reporting on Al-Qaeda and its European affiliates, and was part of the CNN reporting team that covered the London July 7, 2005 attacks. Tim covered international news for over 25 years as a producer and reporter for the BBC and CNN. He has both lived and worked in the Middle East, and has also worked in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In 2004, he produced the award-winning documentary Between Hope and Fear, Journeys in the New Iraq for CNN, and he is now a contributor and producer for Turner Broadcasting, where he writes for CNN.com on international topics, including security issues, terrorism, and Europe. Paul, Tim, welcome to the International Spy Museum. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to be with you.
So the reason you're both here today is that you are the co-authors of a book that is now coming out in the United States called Agent Storm, My Life Inside Al-Qaeda and CIA, which you co-wrote with the Agent Storm in question, Morton Storm. Tim, I want to ask you, how did you first hear about the story of Morton Storm?
Well, it's pretty interesting because we'd been in touch with some Danish journalists on other jihadist-related issues. And there's a newspaper in Denmark called Jyllands-Posten that Morton first approached with his amazing story. They published it at some length. And we managed to trace Morton partly through them, but partly through a company that he'd once run, an outdoor adventure company. And once we located him, after a little bit of negotiation, he agreed to do an interview for television. And then we thought, there's enough here for a book.
And I actually first came across Morton back in 2005. I was reporting on some radical groups in the UK, and I'd gone up to a meeting organised by one of them, a group called Al-Muhajirun, which is a pro-Al-Qaeda group in Britain, and the leader of the group at the time had invited me up there. And outside, after the event, there were a few guys who were sort of talking to me from the group. And all those years later, when I first met Morton, I realized that I'd met him back in 2005 when he was still very radical.
The story itself, if you told it to me without knowing the background, it's almost unbelievable. I think I imagine you had to put many, many hours as journalists into investigating the legitimacy of this story before anything. I mean, in Europe, you're probably a lot more familiar with the story before the United States. I mean, we're just starting to become familiar with this, especially now that books come out, we're going to be even more familiar, and then we'll talk about the movie shortly. But as a journalist, as a historian myself, if I saw a story like this, I'd be like, I need to do a lot of investigation. How much independent investigation did you do into the story?
Oh, a huge amount. And obviously, we wanted it to be in our comfort zone. And what's so unique about Morton's story is he has gigabytes and gigabytes of audiovisual data which corroborate his account, and they also sort of enrichen his account when you're kind of working with him to kind of write the story. You have actual conversations between him and his CIA handlers, actual conversations with his Danish intelligence handlers. You have emails between him and the terrorists. You have invoices from front companies used by Danish intelligence to pay him. You have visa stamps, so you're able to chart all the various trips that he makes over the years, and you're able to fit that very closely with his account. We had, what, Tim, like almost 100 hours of recordings by the end of it with Mawson.
Yes, we did, and we went over his experiences time and again to make sure that what he told us held water. We covered the dates, checked them off against other sources and where he could have been and what he might have seen and who he might have met, and it all fit really well. Plus, we went to Denmark and spoke to friends and family there as well to get more texture on his early life, which was pretty remarkable. Pretty much of an upheaval for him. So we got to really know the guy very, very well and checked everything off. It took a long time, all the research. The writing was, if anything, the easy bit.
Had you two worked together before with CNN or writing other things together?
Absolutely. We Tim and I had done sort of much reporting together, a lot of articles over the years, reporting on Al-Qaeda terrorism and all the other different affiliates of Al-Qaeda and the threat to Europe and the United States. And so when this story came out, when we first saw it, we were like, blooming heck, you know, this is the story of all stories. I mean, this is quite a remarkable account of someone who not only went deep inside the world of Al-Qaeda, but also deep inside the world of Western intelligence. No one like him has come forward to tell their story in the post 9/11 age.
Well, there's clearly some controversy with this book, with the idea that the CIA does not acknowledge his role in finding and eventually, you know, being part of the death of Anwar al-Awlaki. Here at the Spy Museum, we try to be as objective as we possibly can. As a historian, I try to be as unbiased as I possibly can. As journalists, that's part of what you try to do as well. But I imagine, do you come down on one side or the other? I know you know Morton Storm. You've worked with him now for years. Is there a temptation to kind of put the journalism aside a little bit and say, this guy has to be telling the truth?
Well, there are two interesting data points here. One is this recording with this CIA handler. And in that recording, this CIA handler, who's called Michael, he says on tape, you played the highest role. And that could be interpreted in many different ways. But clearly, that was in the operation to go after al-Awlaki. Now, whether that was the overall operation or the final specific bit of it is open to, obviously, interpretation. Clearly, the CIA's interpretation, according to that recording, was the final specific bit of it wasn't Morton, because they weren't able to give him the money. But later, a year later, there's another recording with Danish intelligence where they say on tape that Morton was not treated well over the al-Awlaki thing, and they're apologizing to him for this. So his own handlers in Denmark saying, you should have got the $5 million reward, essentially, on tape. So those are two interesting data points, which, as far as Morton is concerned, he sees that as corroborating his story, and you know, for legitimate reasons.
There's an even potentially more controversial part of this book in that at least Morton Storm's compatriot, whether he was an al-Qaeda, jihadist or a double agent himself, warned Morton Storm in Asia that the CIA was plotting to kill him, to kind of get him out of the way so that he can't talk about his role in al-Awlaki and everything else. This is in the book, certainly. This is left somewhat ambiguously in the book so that the reader can make up their own mind. And it almost seems like Storm doesn't really buy this as much himself. Am I reading that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah, he doesn't know for sure. But he was given this warning. And if you inhabit that spy world, you know, you're bound to be paranoid at a certain amount, you know, point of time, given, you know, the sort of missions that he was employed for the CIA.
I think the part of the joy, if you like, perhaps the wrong word, part of the fascination of writing this book is it's so difficult to prove or disprove much of it. Exactly. Who was it who led the CIA to al-Awlaki? Was it Morton's guy? It's quite plausible. It's quite conceivable it was. But they were clearly running other traps as well. Same applies with Morton's friend, who he'd known for quite a long time, and who had a very mixed record, it has to be said. but had clearly been involved at a very high level with some very dangerous people, people linked, for example, to the 1998 bombing of the US embassies in East Africa. He was an operator, this guy. Whether he'd gone off the rails, whether Morton took at face value what he said, and then on second thoughts, maybe it wasn't quite plausible, conceivable. It's all open to question. You cannot be 100% categorically sure of a lot of this stuff.
As terrorism experts, I want to ask you this question. My primary focus is scientific and technological intelligence. That's my field. And I found something very interesting in this book, that the use and the increasing use of technology by terrorist organizations, whether it was all the different burner phones, the smartphones, but also the encryption technology, the Mujahideen secrets, and the knowledge of how to get around Western intelligence use of technology. And of course, you see that more and more today with ISIS and terrorism, you know, with the Snowden revelations and them figuring out what they can and can't do. Is that something that struck you when you were writing this book about this use, or is it just something that you see every day as people who cover terrorism?
I think it was very striking and notable for the fact they were doing this, Mujahideen secrets and other encryption software, to get around Western intelligence tracking them well before the revelations of Edward Snowden. Al-Qaeda and other affiliates were aware that American spy agencies were trying to and had the ability to track their communications and were taking precautions. As I said, well before all these revelations came out, there've always been a lot of controversy about the Snowden revelations. Have Al-Qaeda completely changed the way they do business? Well, actually, they're already being very careful way before Edward Snowden hit the headlines.
I think that's true. Works both ways, of course, because Morton was in contact with some pretty dangerous people in Somalia. And on one particular instance, he supplied the equipment that had been suitably tailored by the CIA in terms of a BlackBerry and a laptop that killed Naban, who was a senior guy in Al-Shabaab. So, you know, both sides are using as much technology as they possibly can. And it's a constant battle. One side moves ahead, the other one catches up, and so on. And it's only going to get more complex as technology evolves and as Al-Qaeda realizes that it needs some young, smart technicians on its side. And it values these people very, very highly, that they're very highly thought of and well-protected. So it's going to go on like that, except probably at an exponentially faster rate.
One of the things that jumped out at me in the book is the decision by Morton Storm to leave radical Islam behind and to volunteer to spy for the West, to spy for PET, which is Danish intelligence, and then in turn MI6 and CIA. In the book, there's no real great explanation, or at least one that I found as, you know, here is the laundry list, the bullet pointed list of why I'm deciding to do this. There's some information about not being able to go to Somalia, and this was a crisis of faith. There's information about him never wanting to hurt innocents. And of course, this is somewhat diametrically opposed to the ideas of Al-Qaeda. And there's conversations he had with people inside Denmark or about in London about you know, how to use his talents in a perhaps better way by teaching people to read and training people and not turning them into soldiers. What is your perspective on this? Why did Morton Storm decide to be a double agent?
We spent many hours going over this very point with Morton, trying to get him to retrieve from his memory just what was going through his mind at the end of 2006, beginning 2007. I don't think it was a sort of Damascene conversion, if you like. I think it was a process that had begun sometime previously when he was uncomfortable at the very least with the idea that it was legitimate to attack civilians and kill people. He imagined his own mother and ex-girlfriend and so forth becoming victims to some random terror attack on the streets of Denmark, for example. But I think there was a moment. Somalia, to him, was important. He wasn't setting out to go and carry guns for Al-Shabaab and kill lots of people. He wanted to go and support the Islamist movement there by actually doing dairy farming as opposed to fighting. So it wasn't as though he had become a fully fledged jihadist ready to start shooting people at that point. But when he was told, oh, you can't come, his expectations collapsed all of a sudden, and that made him reconsider a lot of things. And then it was a process thereafter as he began to read the Quran again, to think about some of the things that Awlaki and others had talked to him about. So it was, in that respect, a process, I think, rather than an instant.
And from the religious point of view, he basically, after he can't go to Somalia, he goes up and he Googles contradictions in the Quran, and something propels him. He's not quite sure what into doing this, and he through the night he reads all these various contradictions that people have put forward when it comes to the holy text, the religious text. And because he had a sort of Salafi fundamentalist literal interpretation of Islam, it was a bit like a house of cards. You take one card away, there's one contradiction, and the rest falls down. And it's because he had really this literal understanding that it all was eviscerated relatively quickly over a period of weeks and months, and then completely disappeared. And of course, he was then extremely angry to some degree that he'd been duped by this. But he also realized just how dangerous the people were that wanted to go after him. His former friends, he realized, if they knew the process he'd just been through, would want him dead.
Right. To me, one of by far the most interesting subplot. Well, there are two. There's the Amina story, which is where Morton Storm gets a wife for Anwar al-Awlaki. But the al-Awlaki story itself is, to me, the most interesting subplot. I mean, the Storm story as the plot is fascinating, but the al-Awlaki story as an American, as somebody who has studied the ideas behind when it's justified to kill a terrorist, someone, again, who does S&T, who looks at drone technology and other things. The idea of al-Awlaki, it's very easy to dismiss because you see him on TV. He looks like a bad guy. He looks like bin Laden's son. I mean, he's very much the stereotypical from central casting Arab bad guy. But when you hear him talk, and he's got no accent because he was born in New Mexico, he has a lot of Americanisms in his speech, and a lot of the emails that Morton Storm has provided show his true Americanism, where he's using just jargon and slang, emoticons, smiley faces at the end of emails when he's talking about how Amina looks. It made me sit back and say, he is a real American. Now, he's a terrorist bad guy, or he was, a better word, but it makes me think twice. I mean, is that something that it's obviously going to continue to be an issue, because there is no real answer to this justification for killing Americans without a trial. Are those things that came up when you were thinking about this book, or was it the story?
I think it was both. I think there's a lot of very fascinating aspects to al-Awlaki as a person, as a preacher. He attracted so many would-be jihadists, or people who were actually quite lost, whether they were sitting in rather cramped apartments in London or rural townships in Pennsylvania or wherever. He was extraordinarily alluring to these people. So as a character, he was fascinating. His own evolution as a person. After all, he gave an interview just after 9/11 saying these people who did this don't represent Islam and so forth and so on. His own path to radicalization is itself extremely interesting. The people he attracted, extremely interesting. His experiences in the United States while he was under investigation by the FBI. There were so many aspects to it. He was radicalized, but at the same time, a lot of it with him was personal. He felt that he'd been persecuted here, picked upon, humiliated. So there were, again, so many aspects with him as a character.
And he becomes the one guy within the Al-Qaeda network who's inspiring a generation of English speakers back in the West towards jihad. And his sermons on DVD and on YouTube really were the inspiration for people involved in many terrorist plots in the West. They all seem to have one common denominator, and they were all listening to al-Awlaki, and that included the Fort Hood shooter, Nidal Hassan, who'd exchanged emails with al-Awlaki in the period before the shooting. And it's after the Fort Hood shooting, which is in November 2009, that the CIA tell Morton, we need to get this guy. That's when the gloves came off, as far as Morton recalls. That's when they told him they wanted to go after him. And he asked, does that mean you want to arrest him? And his handler, Jed, says, no.
Well, I don't think so. Words to that effect. But the other interesting thing about al-Awlaki, which I don't think should be neglected, is sex. Because he was a sex addict. He was involved in all sorts of liaisons in the Washington area with, for want of a better word, escorts. The feds were after him. But it's a pattern, because you see this with so many other jihadists. They've got this very, very messed up view about the role of women and how women should be treated and so forth. Some of the 9/11 hijackers, Nidal Hassan was another one. So that was a really interesting aspect of him too.
And early on, you know, Morton had real reservations about whether he should be killed, or that maybe they should try and kind of arrest him, lure him to Sana so that they could arrest him. Real reservations, because after all, this was one of his mentors, his friend, somebody he'd known for many years. He knew his kids. But during the course of 2011, Morton comes to realize that Awlaki is a huge danger to the West. And one of the reasons he realizes this is that Awlaki is interested in New York Times reporting on AQAP, his group, developing a plan to put the poison, the toxin ricin, in bombs. And Morton realizes this is what Awlaki is up to. This is what he's planning. This is what he's capable of. And so he moved from a position of, well, hopefully we can maybe arrest him, take him off the battlefield that way, to a position where this guy is incredibly dangerous. He could be plotting catastrophic terrorism against the West. He's inspiring people to do this. He needs to be taken out. And so there's this big debate in the United States about how much of a danger Awlaki was. From Morton's perspective, he came to realize that he was a very large danger indeed.
And I think that echoed Morton's own evolution as far as Islam was concerned as well. This was a progression on his part from thinking that as a friend of his, he'd really like Awlaki not to be murdered from thin air, but to be arrested and kept in Yemeni custody and so forth. And that, although the circumstances were very different, was a kind of almost repeated some of the things that went on with his own evolution as far as his view of Islam was concerned, and then ultimately turning away from Islam. It wasn't an overnight decision. He's a guy who thinks deeply and constantly about everything he goes through and re-examines his thoughts and his perspectives all the time, and so that is, I think, part of the book, that he's got this constant internal agony about what he's doing going on.
It's a very complicated story, and so when I saw the news report that this was going to eventually be a movie, at first I was excited. It's a fantastic story, but somewhat apprehensive at the same time. A story this complicated, it's not easy to do in a two-hour movie. There's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts. I'm sure excitement, something you guys felt when you first heard this as well. Is there apprehension about the potential Hollywoodization of something you worked so many years on?
I think there's this huge sense of excitement. I mean, the Paul Greengrass, the director developing this, is somebody who is, proven track record of putting out fantastic movies on this kind of, genre, the reality genre. He's someone, who was responsible for a couple of the Bourne films, for the recent movie with Tom Hanks,
Captain Phillips, '93.
And so, somebody who's just incredibly skilled at putting these kind of movies together. And as authors, really, very confident in the capability of him and his team to kind of put something really exciting together, and you've got to take a step back as authors at a certain point.
And there's obviously some trepidation when you hand the baby over to someone else and see how they treat it. There's bound to be. But at the same time, I think it's really important that an entirely new audience will be brought to this story through the film, that won't read the book. Right. That will understand, hopefully, a little bit about how people become Islamic extremists or jihadists, what goes through their mind, and how, in the end, some of them do actually think, this is not for me. And Morton's not alone in that. A lot of other people have repented, if you will, and have decided this is not the path for me. And he's a great example, but he's not exceptional. And as long as I get to play the old lady in the burqa in scene 4, I'll be just fine about it.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's Spycast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.